And you are listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota Clearwater Community Conscious Radio. Hi, I'm Mary Glennie.
And I'm Arlene Engelhart. And you are listening to From a Woman's Point of View. We hope you'll stay with us for the next hour. We have a filled show today, don't we, Mary?
Well, it's a very busy time of year. And even though it's virtual, I would have to go virtual, still things are happening. Film festivals are continuing. And a really very worthwhile one. It's now in its 22nd year down in Sarasota. And then we're going to be actually talking about the only woman in the Bay Cooperstown's Baseball Hall of Fame. And I think you'll want to learn about Effa Manley. And then what's happening with some of the New York people with Kumho. And so we're talking to Alexis Grinnell regarding that. So, yes, very full show.
And you no longer need a radio to listen to WMNF. And that includes our show. You can tune in anytime. Of course, you can still hear us at 88.5 FM. You can also stream WMNF at WMNF.org. Listen to the WMNF app or tell your smart speaker to play WMNF. And you can tune in to the archives anytime and listen to your favorite show.
Well, you know, I think we will. Oh, we are going to remind them that actually next week is marathon. I think that's really particularly why I wanted to pack so much in this week, because we'll be limited to stuff we can bring you next week, because next week we are going to ask you to contribute to the station and the show. And we're pretty excited because I think, I don't know about you, but to me, WMNF has never been more important in my life.
And if you'd like to get ahead of the game, you can make your contribution now and it will still count toward the goal. Just go to WMNF.org and put something in the tip jar. And we also, I forgot what I was going to say, Mayor.
Oh, well, that's not a good sign.
Oh, Monday is International Women's Day.
Oh, my word, yes.
And I understand that most of the shows will be hosted by women on Monday.
Oh, great.
Our new program director will be hosting the afternoon music show that Flea usually hosts, so you can tune in to listen to Sam.
Oh, great. Oh, that's wonderful. I'm really glad to hear that. Okay, because it's always really a very, very special day. And that's one of the reasons I went out to Film Festival, because they have it in conjunction also with International Women's Day. So, very special time. Okay, I'm going to put this music on, and then we will be coming back with our first guest, E. Scott Osborne, with Through Women's Eyes. Guest with us on the phone, and so I'm going to pod this music down, and I am so happy to welcome actually back to the show E. Scott Osborne, and she is actually, she's the president of UN Women USA Gulf Coast Chapter, but she's also the chair of Through Women's Eyes Film Festival, which, Scott, did I see that it's actually the 22nd year?
22nd year, that is absolutely correct. Yes, we're very proud of that.
Well, you should be. And not rain, sleet, or fire, but also a pandemic is not going to stop you. And so, unfortunately, but still, it's going to be quite exciting. This year, you had to go virtual, right?
It's our first year all virtual. That's correct. It's been a learning curve, but we're actually delighted with the idea that people can now watch from anywhere they are.
Yeah, and also they still have the discussions, because I imagine you've managed to work that in too, haven't you?
We did. We have four audience discussions. One of the things people love about coming together watching these films is the chance to talk about them afterwards. People sort of normally, they leave the theater, they're chatting, that sort of thing. So we organized four different open discussion sessions just for the audience to come on four of the different themes that we have. So we're pretty excited about that. They'll be on Sunday and Monday because our film festival is between Friday at 4 p.m. we open to Monday at 4 p.m. So on Sunday and Monday, we have four discussion sessions.
So you mentioned four different themes. What are the themes?
Well, the themes, we have a number of different themes of the films. And one of the great things, and I hope at some point here we can give people the site so that they can go look at it. But on the site, people can actually search for different themes in our festivals. For example, we have a few on athletics. So you can tab the athletic life and see what there is. But the themes that we're having on discussion sessions are clustered around a few things that we have a number of films. One is the environment. One is LGBTQ experience. One is what we call young at heart. And the other is emerging filmmakers. Emerging filmmakers is our category for young and filmmakers and those still in film school. So again, that's the environment, LGBTQ, emerging filmmakers, and young at heart. Those are the themes that we're having discussion sessions on. And we have films that cluster around each of those categories as well as others.
Yes, I think all told you have what, 34 films? 12?
We do.
Pardon me?
We do, 34 films. Yeah. And we're there from all different countries. We pride ourselves on our international representation. And I think we have 24, 23 different countries represented this year, which even for us is amazing.
Yeah, and as you said, it's so much fun afterwards, going across the street or wherever and having coffee and continuing the discussion of the films, but also in the films themselves. We go around the world, and I always find that that's the very best thing about the festival. And that's the same thing here. I noticed that you've got the Indian women. You also just have a beautiful film about four or five women from Jordan, and I can't remember the other countries right now. But also you have a couple of Australian films. And I find that's just as valuable, Scott, that you not only talk among yourselves about all these issues, but you see the issues being discussed all around the world.
It's such a fascinating component. You know, even though we can sit home and, you know, stream all these different films, there's something so special about these. And they come from places that you just don't see typically. For example, this year we have one from Iran called Born of the Earth, and we have one from Afghanistan called When Mama's Gone. And both of them are not the kind of thing that you would see. It certainly is not what you read about in the newspapers about Afghanistan or Iran. You know, it has nothing to do with war or anything like that. And you see real life in a way that is both intimate and charming. And I mean, I would think that should be required for Americans. We're so deeply involved in these countries to see it from the perspective of filmmakers there and just to see what real life is like is fascinating.
Well, and you mentioned Born of the Earth. And you know, I must admit, I really zeroed in on that. To me, I think that looks like just an extraordinarily beautiful film. And it's about this little guy that actually they rescue him from drowning. Isn't that right?
That's correct. And what we loved about that film, it's made by a woman filmmaker, but it's got the number of themes in there. A young boy, without giving away too many details, is rescued from the ocean and by a sea captain off the shores, and he goes into port in Iran, and they don't know what to do with this boy. And eventually he gets taken in by a mother and daughter who are running this facility at a nearby port. And so you see their interactions, and you see a lot of what then happens to this boy, but you also have a separate theme about this sea captain and his own experiences with fatherhood and how this boy makes him think about fatherhood differently. And you see this mother and daughter without a husband trying to run a business and what that life is like. And then you see the daughter come of age and someone be interested in her for marriage. And there's just a whole number of themes woven into it. But you see also, you know, people sharing meals in this wonderful setting. So got a lot packed into that one.
Yeah, and you also mentioned When Mom Is Gone. And I thought that one looked particularly fascinating, too, because this is set in Afghanistan, right?
Correct.
And I don't want to give away too much, but when mom is gone, what, the oldest child in the family is 11, right? So the father has 11 on down, right?
Correct. Right down to, I think, 2 is the youngest. And so we see a father. We don't know anything about what's transpired, But you see a father caring for all of his children in rural Afghanistan. You see snippets of what life is like. This is a short. You see snippets of what life is like for each of the children. And the interviewer, and obviously it's subtitled, about what their lives are like. And you see this family without a mom and what their life is like. And the charm of it, as well as the struggles of the father and the perspectives of the children. And I think that one is only maybe 15 or 20 minutes, as are some of our shorts. But there's so much packed into there. I mean, you cry. It's very poignant.
And you mentioned there are some athletic films, and I like sports, and I particularly like running. And I noticed you have, I think, just an absolutely fascinating one, The Long Haul. She's actually a Florida woman, Katie Rosar, and she did a 100-mile ultra marathon. And do you know, did she finish, and was she okay from it? Do you know about that?
She did finish. She was okay. And this is, we call this a local film. The filmmaker is in St. Pete. And I love this one. I love athletics, too. And to see her running. But we've said to some people, here's the wonderful thing about watching this from anywhere. You see a Florida that the tourists don't see. I mean, those of us who live here know about what I call the central parts of Florida and the woods and the parks. And a lot of her running takes place in those settings. So it's the Florida, which isn't just, you know, beaches and theme parks. You see her running through really beautiful environments in, you know, kind of rural Florida, but it's also about her quest and her team to do this for the first time, 100 miles straight. And so it's definitely a testament to a lot of dedication.
Well, you know, I've run not on those trails, but, you know, people here in Florida, they really need to get out to our state parks and some of our parks because they really are beautiful. But also there are all kinds of trails in the forest preserves. And I noticed she ran a lot on the forest preserves. And I thought, wow, I thought that this is some kind of woman. And I was able to download that trailer. And so let's give a listen to it. Well, for whatever reason, it doesn't seem to want to run. So, okay. Well, I'm sorry about that, but hopefully the next one will. Okay.
That's all right. If anyone is running, I was going to say you might see scenes that you recognize. I mean, exactly, from these state parks, and you'll see familiar places, perhaps.
And the other one, you have a whole day in the life of Hockey Mad Canada. And I thought, you know, with hopefully the Olympics maybe eventually coming up, and particularly we have a good women's team and the men's team is good too. But also you have a lot of movies that I thought were great about immigration and the problems with immigrants. And Kathy's Way, isn't that the name of it, this Australian film?
Rosemary's Way.
I'm sorry. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure, and that's interesting. We do have, just by coincidence, a couple of on immigration. We also have another one called Undocumented, a short that was one of our emerging filmmakers that I highly recommend. But Rosemary's Way is one of my personal favorites, and this, it's set in Australia. It gives you a view of Australia that probably many of us, if we're not familiar with that country, haven't thought about the immigrant community. And it especially features this woman, Rosemary. It's a documentary, who is originally from Kenya, who's an immigrant to Australia, and her work to help assist and bring out all the other communities of immigrant women there, of which there are many, many. You know, it's something like the U.S. in that, you know, it's a nation of immigrants, as are we. But many of them are very closed off. They either don't speak the language, they don't have employment, and her job and her passion is to help work with these women. And that doesn't really give justice to her personality, which is what drives the film. She just has this sense of vibrancy and can-do and humor that is infectious. You will feel inspired about what woman can do. But through listening to the lives of some of the women who she works with, you get a sense of the immigrant experience. And it's really upbeat. It's really uplifting in the end. I can say that she takes the women to on a trip into Central Australia. And so they stay at homestays with other primarily white Australian women. And, you know, many of them say, I've never been in the home of a person who lived here before. I don't know what an Australian person has for breakfast, for example. And they go spend the weekend with another woman. And the next thing you know, they're having coffee and they're chatting and they're sharing their lives. and how formative that is for women who haven't had any of those contacts. So it's really uplifting, and it's an interesting look at Australia, but it's just inspiring because of the capability and the humor and the zest of this woman, Rosemary.
Okay, well, I am going to try one more of the trailers, because, as you said, immigrants. And one of the ones I really found fascinating was Women of Steel. And I thought that really, and in a way, to me, it encapsulates, you know, what the whole thing is about. So let's hope this one will play.
If people said you are going to fight against a giant, I don't care. I have to do it.
BHP was the biggest, most powerful company in Australia.
Had over 20,000 people.
Migrant women wanted to work at the steelworks, and they wanted a better future for themselves and their children.
We were told there were no jobs for women.
You work no give job for women, just men.
But no work, no income.
Well, that wasn't fair. Saying there's no jobs for women is discrimination.
A lot of these jobs in BHP surely would be very difficult, dirty jobs.
They're too fat, they're too small, they're too this, they're too that.
They would not negotiate.
Well, one I nearly threw off the bridge because he was being very cheeky.
The company just denied discrimination.
They don't have the skills.
But all these people have got the same type of face.
It's not legal.
That was very difficult for both parties to fully understand the other.
And we had to say no.
Half of them wouldn't know how to speak English.
The company did nothing. So we decided, right, we'll take it to them.
I thought to myself, we're taking on a giant.
They're trying to get jobs for women in the steel industry.
Hundreds of women started turning up.
Men say if women are crazy.
Australia's longest-running sexual discrimination case.
Sexual discrimination?
Sexual discrimination.
The whole community.
March on Canberra.
We broke down the doors of Parliament House.
People were just blown away.
One judge has referred to it as being as significant as the basic wage case.
People waiting long time, how many years?
The hall was packed.
The best man for the job might be a woman.
I don't agree with that.
Really?
I have never said that at all.
Really?
If a group of women get together, we can be strong. We can achieve a lot.
The superintendent came out and he said, I hope you're not going to make any trouble. I just smiled and said,
I just think that's really outstanding, Scott. And that, to me, was typical of the kind of films. And I wish we had a lot more time, but I really want to go back because it's virtual this year. So they're not going to go down to Sarasota to see a theater. They can be right in their home. And as you say, it starts tomorrow. I think you said at 4 and ends at 4 and then ends on Monday. And so where can they find out the information and the schedule, and, you know, so they can go through the films?
Sure, absolutely. So the site is TWE, like for women's eyes, TWE2021, our year, .eventive.org. Again, that's TWE2021.eventive, eventive.org. And that has the platform, all of the films. I will say you can buy an individual film for only $10, no fees, no nothing else. You can buy a five film pass, which many people enjoy. They're not sure they want it. Or you can buy an all festival pass and spend the whole weekend watching. We also have an award ceremony at 5:00 on Monday, and that's open to anyone, no extra charge, which is always a lot of fun. Every film, for those of you who've been to our festival, know every film you vote. If you are in the audience, we need your votes to determine our awards, and you will still have a chance to vote on the site after you watch the film.
Okay, and so any other film? I know there are so many we didn't have a chance to talk about, but any one you particularly wanted to mention before I let you go?
Well, we have a number under the beacon of Young at Heart, which are about the elderly, and look into Trust Frank and Garden Shark. Everyone will love them, but it really shows people in that later chapter of life with humor and dignity and charm that are just amazing.
Well, Arlene, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I did post the link on our Facebook page, too, so people can go there and link to the schedule and all the information.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, Scott, I'm going to go out. Actually, I'm going to hope I can get this trailer to play because one that I think will be particularly of interest to a lot of people in this area, Guardians of the Gulf. And I think that's really important. So, listen, thanks so much. It looks like a great lineup again. And I just think it's such a great festival of for about and about women. And it's just such a powerful thing. So, okay.
Thank you so much, Mary.
Thank you. Bye-bye. You do take care. Bye-bye.
This is one of the hardest working bodies of water on this planet. It is not only productive, but it's very, very special place. It plays a really important role for a lot of people, and it deserves and needs our attention. If we want to keep this ecosystem, we're going to have to think differently about the Gulf of Mexico.
Many predictions about climate change and sea level rise indicate that we're going to have more intense storms. And we've seen that. But now we don't even need a hurricane to have damages caused by the Gulf.
I grew up in this water. She's kind, and she's also brutal at the same time. When Hurricane Ike came through, it silted over 80% of the oyster reefs in the bay. Some of those areas have never come back, and they won't, in my opinion.
In the last 30 years, the ocean has come to a tipping point. It's overexploited. So we need to take care of it, because if we don't do it, we're going to have a serious problem in feeding the whole world.
We're playing at a different scale. And so when we make mistakes, that scales too. You can't remove that much seafood. You can't produce that much energy. You can't have that much cargo moving through a system and give nothing back. This is one of those places where we really can make a difference. It's not that it can't be done. It's that it's going to take all of us in order to get it done.
Indeed, and that's one of the many outstanding films. And so really check it out. It's a wonderful thing every year, the festival. And even though it's virtual this year, I still think it has a lot to offer. Well, going on to our next guest, I'm really going to put this little music back on again. And then we will be coming back with Andrea Williams. Pod this music down because I am so excited. With us on the phone is a young woman who's written an extraordinary book, Baseball's Leading Lady, Effa Manley, and the Rise and Fall of the Negro Leagues. And we have Andrea Williams, and she is the author, the journalist. She's worked in marketing development for the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. And she will tell us how she's now in Nashville and has come to write this book. So, Andrea Williams, welcome so much to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, baseball season's just about ready to start, and the avid sport. But, you know, I must admit, Andrea, you know, I am a baseball fan. And, I thought the, you know, integration of the major leagues was way overdue. But I must admit, I certainly did not realize that there was this extensive history long before Jackie Robinson broke into the major leagues. And I think reading your book, I think it really was extraordinary because you really tie in so many aspects of what the conditions for African Americans, how they had to provide, so to speak, their own communities and kind of totally support themselves. And so to tell you the truth, I think the history, I found it actually more interesting than actually Jackie Robinson.
Mm. Yeah. That is, you know, it's why I wanted to write the book. You know, you're not alone in saying that. You just weren't aware of this stuff. And, you know, I grew up as a huge baseball fan and then went to school and studied sport management and had a dream of working in a front office, you know, ultimately becoming a general manager of a Major League Baseball team. But after graduation, my first job was at the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. So I knew a bit about black baseball. I knew of Jackie Robinson, of Satchel Paige and Josh Gibson, but I didn't really understand how significant these leagues were to the black community. I certainly wasn't aware of stories like Effa Manley's story, Gus Greenlee, Rube Foster, these other, you know, executives, black executives and managers who really provided the space, who created the teams for Josh and Satch and ultimately Jackie Robinson to play on before he was signed by Branch Rickey. So, yeah, the ultimate goal is to introduce people to a history that they just don't know much about.
Well, and Effa Manley, is she the only woman in the Baseball Hall of Fame?
She is currently the only woman inducted into the National Baseball Hall of Fame. Yes, that is correct.
And what a woman! But you know that I really didn't think that much about it. You know, baseball is known as a national pastime. I think football gives it a pretty close second. But you know that I really didn't stop to think that they were playing baseball even before the Civil War, and during the Civil War, you know, both sides played baseball. Everybody played mm-hmm. baseball. It was kind of relaxing, and so I had no idea that there were Negro leagues and Negro teams. As early as what, 1868?
Yeah, I like you said, everyone played baseball, and so once we start to see, you know, initially, you know, you would see, you know, black players and white players play together, but once you have the institution of this gentleman's agreement that really, you know, serves as a line of segregation for the sport. Black people still want to play, you know, that it doesn't just because they can no longer play with white players on white teams. That doesn't mean that they don't play anymore. So yeah, they quickly, you know, formed their own teams. It took a little time before they organized into leagues, but they were always playing, you know, before Rube Foster started the first successful league in the 1920, the Negro National League, a lot of independent teams, they just barnstormed around wherever they could find, you know, a willing team and a decent-sized fan base to cover the cost of travel, they were ready to play. They were ready to put on a contest.
Yeah, and actually very early then, you had an African-American pitcher and a catcher. In other words, they were the battery, the heart of the team, if you will. But this was before the quotes, unwritten gentleman's agreement. And as I said, this is such a history of racism that naturally after the Civil War, whites really weren't welcoming to African-Americans, whether it was in the South or the North, because an awful lot, the real heart of baseball was actually in the North, particularly in the East. Mm-hmm. And so the conditions they had there, and so it was particularly difficult because if you want to aspire to play at the highest level, you have to have development, so to speak. You have to have fields. You have to have coaches. You have to have and time to actually mature to be that good. And so the difficulties that these African-American athletes suffered, but they kept persevering, were really kind of heartbreaking. And I'm thinking of particularly Octavio Pox, wasn't that his name?
Octavius Cotto.
Oh, Cotto, I'm sorry. Pox, I don't want to call him Pox. Now, he obviously was a fascinating man, fabulous athlete, but he was actually a free black, and he was pretty well-to-do, educated, et cetera, and a terrific baseball player. And so tell us just a little bit about him. I was very impressed by him.
Yeah, he really, we see this later with Effa, and other executives, Gus Greenlee, who started the second Negro National League after Rube Foster. Gus was also responsible for starting the East-West All-Star Game in Chicago. Octavius, along with those other people I just mentioned, really saw baseball as an opportunity for his community. It was an opportunity to provide jobs, opportunity to make money.
you know, this is the beginning of baseball, not just as the sport that people like to play because it's fun and like to watch because it's entertaining, but baseball as a business. And, yeah, Octavius was really at the forefront of pushing for Black involvement in that, again, not just because of the entertaining aspects of it, but as a money-making opportunity. And yeah, as I mentioned, you know, we see this later with Effa. Effa, you know, when she starts her team, when her and Abe purchase this team, their first year they are in Brooklyn, they move to Newark in 1936. Effa immediately grounds her team in the Black Newark community, and she is constantly doing things to push that Black community forward. She's raising money for the local chapter of the NAACP at games. She's hosting anti-lynching protests at games. She, you know, has a youth program so local Black kids can come to see the games for free, can really get to meet, get up close with their stars, their heroes at the time. So, yeah, this is a baseball book, but really it's about Black empowerment, and it's about how through the era of segregated baseball, really these teams were at the forefront of empowering the Black community.
If I could go back, though, just a few minutes to Octavius Cato, because, you know, the 15th Amendment gave him the right to vote, but don't try and do it. And so right. He was going to vote. And so he bought a gun, but it didn't help him much, and he was shot several times, and he was never able to form a league. And that's the price he was paying.
Right.
Yeah. And so I'm going to go back, though, to the star of this book, Effa Manley. Effa Manley is, born in Philadelphia, and she's quite light-skinned. Her mother was, and her mother was a wonderful seamstress, and apparently she was working for this stockbroker, and they had a relationship, whether consensual or not. And so Effa was very light-skinned, could easily pass for a white. And so I thought it was interesting when she was like, 7 years old, she goes to school. And as one is so aware reading this book, but also living life, and the more I learn about that whole period, or still now, in the schools, that there were a few integrated schools, not a lot, mm-hmm. but a few. And so, but the little white kids played with the white kids, the Black kids played with the Black kids, and they didn't mix. And Effa always, she came from a big African-American family, even though she was quite light, she always considered herself African-American. And so she played with the Black kids. And so the teacher called her in and very sternly told her that this was not what one did, unless was she really white. And so I thought it was interesting when Effa went home and asked her mother, and instead of getting, because she was pretty confused, only a seven-year-old doesn't know what this is about, and her mom answers her almost with a riddle that I thought really kind of underscored the position kind of that Effa was going to be throughout her whole life,
Yeah, her mother go back to school and tell that principal that you're just as white as she is. So, race as this social construct, really, that was created ultimately to keep, to move certain people ahead and keep other people behind. And so that was, I think, really Effa's first moment in understanding how the world works, how everything is drawn along these color lines. And she was in a position where she could kind of live between. She could pass for white, even though she was, she did have some Black ancestry. And I think in that moment, she really, she had Black siblings and, Black friends at school. And I think it was probably jarring to her as a young girl to hear that just because she looked a certain way, she wasn't supposed to affiliate with those people. And I think for the rest of her life, she really spent her life, wanting to show and to prove that those people who she wasn't supposed to be around were just as good as anybody else, that there was value there, on the baseball field, in the front offices. She later boycotted a Harlem department store because they wouldn't hire Black sales clerks, even though most of their revenue came from the Black community. So she was advocating for Black women, who, you know, were darker skinned than her to be able to have good jobs. So, yeah, I think that was the moment for her where she really kind of drew a line in the sand and said, you know what, this doesn't make sense to me. This isn't right. And I'm going to do whatever is in my power to try to fix it.
Yeah, and so a young Effa, when she is 18 or 19, she takes off for New York City. And I thought it was fascinating also when you're talking about Harlem, because as so many times, many things, that, you know, developers will develop an area with an idea selling, you know, to prospective buyers. Well, the sales in this particular area were not going that well. They're going pretty slow. And so the one realtor said, well, why, let me put in African-American people, and I think we'll fill it. And so the Harlem, you know, we think of the Harlem Renaissance, and we think, you know, it's a lot of music, artists, et cetera. But I did not realize that all the intelligentsia, all the professionals. So she had, you know, the Thurgood Marshall, she had all of them there. And so she was hearing W.D. Du Bois. She was hearing Garvey. And so she was getting all these ideas. And then eventually she meets her husband, Manley. And so I'm going to skip here because I realize we're going to run out of time. So they buy a baseball team because he already had one and it failed. There was a lot of problems. Mm-hmm. But then he knew that Eva was so smart, and he was with her when she was leading that whole boycott against Bloomstein's, the department store. And mm-hmm. so he puts her the manager of the team, and she's just not a manager in name. She is the whole front office. And so we follow Eva and you know, and her other colleagues and how they develop, you know, the leagues. And really, it was extraordinary. It really was.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you're absolutely right. Effa was the front office of that team. And I don't think she had intentions of running a baseball team, you know, as an adult. I don't think she was like me. And, you know, being a kid watching baseball games, I want to run a team when I get older. But she kind of got thrust into this position, and Effa really didn't do anything halfway. She, you know, if she's going to run a team, she's going to do it incredibly well. She's going to put together a really good team. They won the 1946 Negro World Series. And yeah, to your point about her not just running the team in name only, there were other women who owned baseball teams before Effa in both white baseball and black baseball. But Effa was really different in that she didn't hire, you know, we saw, you know, a lot of white women who own teams, they would inherit them from a father or a husband who passed away, but then they ended up hiring a general manager or a president to oversee the day-to-day operations of the club. Effa did everything herself. And that is really why she is the only woman inducted into Cooperstown, is because she had the opportunity even. You know, a lot of these women just simply didn't have the opportunity to run a team, but she had the opportunity to run this team, and she did it really, really well.
And now we're coming up till the war. Branch Rickey, well, Bill Veeck even before him, but Branch Rickey, who was very, very successful as a general manager with the Cardinals, gets to the Brooklyn Dodgers. And he really wanted, and Wendell Smith, a writer, has been writing all along, doing all these surveys about how the players, the major leagues, they wouldn't have a problem playing with an African-American. And Leo Durocher said, no, he wouldn't mind coaching and having a player on his team as long as it was okay with the bosses. And so kind of the ground was getting ready. And so Branch Rickey, being the kind of sly businessman he was, he asked to pick the perfect one, so to speak. And I think if one reads your book, you will see that Jackie Robinson, for all of his marvelous athletic skills, and he was really something, that actually there were other players, you know, Josh Gibson and so many others, Fleetwood Walker, but he was too old by then, even if he was still alive by then. So many others were actually perhaps far more talented, but Jackie was perfect. And so I wish we had more time to go into it, but I can really strongly suggest that, again, people read the book, Baseball's Leading Lady, Effa Manley, and The Rise and Fall of the Negro Leagues. And it's a book readily available. It's actually written for young people, but I found it fascinating. And real quickly, Andrea, I have to keep you just a minute here, that I thought it was fascinating that of all the people, I certainly did not know this, that when Ted Williams was actually inducted into the Cooperstown Hall of Fame, I think he really put a burr in the saddle of the major leagues that, hey, there's been a great oversight here and you need to correct it. Did that surprise you?
You know, yes and no. I mean, it's not surprising that he understood the level of talent there. I mean, you know, if you had seen these men, you knew that they were operating on a level where they should have been inducted into Cooperstown. It is surprising in the sense that, you know, you always want people to stand up and to speak on what's right, and people don't always do that. So when you have people that do, yeah, it's a little surprising. But, yeah, you're 100% right. It's really, you know, he kind of kickstarts this effort to recognize the black players who have been relegated to separate ball fields. And ultimately, when we keep Major League Baseball white, we keep the National Baseball Hall of Fame white, too. And so after Ted Williams makes that speech at his own induction ceremony, that we see, you know, players like Satchel Paige and Josh Gibson, Buck Leonard, Oscar Charleston get inducted.
And, oh, I didn't, we have to real briefly discuss the numbers games. You know, that alone is worth reading the book. I'm serious. I didn't know anything about the numbers game, but I totally, you know, I understand kind of with the lotto now. I think it's kind of
right.
Probably was a forerunner. But tell us about the numbers game, because this is fascinating. This is one of the ways that people got the kind of money, you know, that they could actually buy a team. But far more importantly, kind of the numbers runners, or the one who ran the numbers game, was kind of the unofficial banker of that whole community and did a lot of good things for the community.
Yeah, I mean, again, this is an era where, you know, Jim Crow is really impacting all aspects of life for black people. So you can't, you know, we're also coming out of the Depression, you know, in the 1930s. And so in terms of the part of the book where I'm talking about the numbers game with entrepreneurs like Gus Greenlee, who makes his money running a numbers operation and then uses it to fund his Pittsburgh Crawfords team that, you know, really introduces the world to Satchel Paige. He also has his own ballpark. He pays for the construction of his own ballpark in the heart of Pittsburgh. But to your point, yes, also kind of served as an unofficial banker. The king of the hill, the hill community in Pittsburgh, was where the black community lived. You know, he took care of his people. When Blatt of it as the country, he took care of people. He paid for people's rent or doctor bills, bought groceries. And it was important because black people couldn't get financial support from the government, from banks in the way that white people could. Black entrepreneurs, to the point of Gus really using his numbers operation to fuel his baseball aspirations. He couldn't, you know, he wanted to start a business. He couldn't go to a bank and get a loan to run a black baseball team. So, yeah, it was really important. It was considered illegal at the time, but yeah, ultimately the state takes over the numbers game and it becomes the legal lottery system. So.
Okay, well, Andrea Williams, there's so much you packed into that book, and I'm telling you, it is a valuable history lesson. Baseball's leading lady, F. Up Manly, in the rise and fall of the Negro Leagues. Andrea Williams, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. Keep up the great work, and I'll have to follow your future writings.
Thank you so much for having me.
You take care. Bye-bye. And you are listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota Clearwater Community Conscious Radio. Well, fasten your seatbelt because we still have one more interview. And so I'm going to put this music back on, and then we will come back with our last person. seem to be having trouble reaching Alexis Grinnell, and I'm sorry about that, because I think she would have been a really interesting interview about what's going down with Cuomo in New York. But things happen. I don't know quite why. But anyway, I'm sure you followed it this week, and I thought it was really interesting because Alexis was really emphasizing that, you know, the young women there, are really out there, and they're really, you know, with really, as we know, with sexual harassment and sexual assault, that's kind of a career ender, really, in many ways. They really put themselves out, and it's very, very difficult. It's not easy. And so particularly, I thought, with the last one, Miss Roosh, that here she's at a wedding. And luckily, we actually have it, you know, where somebody was able to film it. And I don't know if you saw it, where Cuomo put both hands on her cheeks and, and at first he put his hand on her back, and that made her so uncomfortable that she brushed it off. And then he puts both hands on her cheeks and says he really would just love to kiss her. And, you know, it's kind of stunning. And so, I don't know. You know, I just don't understand really men like Cuomo, you know, who use that kind of power. And, with the three of them. And I was really impressed because I don't know if you happen to catch part of it, but I thought one of the really outstanding women that's actually in the New York Assembly that has really stepped up and is speaking out, you know, against what Cuomo did. And her name is Yulin Niu, N-I-O-U, Niu. I might pronounce it wrong. Anyway, she's in now the New York Assembly. But she was a legislative aide in 2013, and she really got sick to death of the lawmakers, not just one, but the lawmakers who, would grab her buttocks. They would make very untimely and very suggestive comments to her and told her boss and she were a hot duo. They should have sex, and peered into her office to check her out for a hot or no list. Then she was the chief of staff in her late 20s. She never reported it. Because, first of all, she was afraid it would unduly, because her boss wasn't like that at all. It might get him in trouble. But she also knew that that would be the end of her career there. And so when she listened to Cuomo's marks, I thought she's really totally appropriately called it a faux-pology. You know, F-A-U-X, faux-pology. That blames victims for misrepresenting. You know, they're too rigid. They don't have any sense of humor. And she says that, you know, he now understands my interactions may have been insensitive or too personal. And as Yu Nuo says, when is it a joke to say, do you have sex with older men? I mean, can you imagine that, you know? And she's been a member of the New York Assembly since 2017. But I think it's really pretty trouble being that two of his, Lindsay Boylan, you know, accused him of kissing him around the lips, and she quit. And then another former employee, 25-year-old Charlotte Bennett, asked her about her sex life, et cetera. She quit. And then I think the final thing, Anna Roosh. I repeat, I just don't get it.
There's just way too much of this happening. And I think it seems much longer than that, but isn't it just a year since some of the trials and some of this really...
Harvey Weinstein. Yes.
I mean, what is it that men feel they can control women?
I don't know, but they've got the right attorney general with Letitia James, and that is a story in itself, but we don't have time to go through it. But this is a 20-year, you know, she's part of the Workers' Freedom Party, and she's also one of the ones that's been investigating the inaccurate reporting they were doing, and not just inaccurate, but it really is important. It's misleading.
COVID.
Yeah. You need to know, particularly the early parts of the stages, you needed to know where these people were dying. And I just, to send them back, you know, if they were from a nursing home and they got sent to a hospital and then they were positive, they got sent back to the nursing home. where surely they realized they didn't have the kind of isolation, they didn't have the kind of medical facilities. And to me, that's pretty unconscionable, because they would be the last people you want to be exposed to this highly infectious and pretty seriously lethal disease. And so, but hopefully, you know, that's going to be exposed.
And we do have one thing I'll mention, and that is I'm sorry to say that we lost one of our best theater people.
Anna Brennan,
yes. A little over a week ago, and she was such an influence on theater in the Tampa area. She was a friend of this show. She was certainly a friend of all the theater in this area, and also spoke up for it, and also spoke up for women. Was the first, as I understand it, first woman to produce a show by and about women. And so she will be missed, but fortunately, we do have some of the theater ongoing.
And you have been listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota Clearwater Community Conscious Radio. This has been From a Woman's Point of View. Just keep it tuned in here all day. It's really what you need, particularly now. Thanks so much for listening.
And Rob's going to be coming up with a psychologist, I believe.